We have a painful history in this country with colonialism and apartheid. There's a lot that's been done. Advancements have been made. I don't know if there's been proper accountability so that we avoid that happening again. Maybe to our leaders, I would say, just for 1 second, like, put yourself aside. Isn't that what leadership is about? There are many leaders out there who exist and they're too comfortable and too excited about their positions. And they're so emboldened and they're so powerful from their positions that they forget that they're here to serve.
Do you think everyone's opinion deserves to be heard on these platforms? Mr. Manyathela, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I am so excited and very honored that you're here today. How does it feel to be on the other side of the hot seat
very
today?
Awkward. As you have seen, as I've just settled down, I'm moving around. I don't know how do you sit properly. It's awkward because I'm normally in your position.
Yeah, so you
I'm
never
asking the questions.
You never get used to this.
I never get used to this. In fact, I normally don't even agree much to being interviewed because it's always so awkward for me. Because I'm like, I don't have much to be interviewed about, but yeah. I've got a lot to interview people about.
Yeah.
And when you've been doing this for so long, you get used to being on the other side. So the minute you are positioned on the other side, then it's like, I wonder how this is going to turn out. So I hope this will turn out good.
Nah, thank you for trusting me. I know you're fresh from a holiday right now, and I am so curious because lately when you're abroad, you always have iconic moments now.
Yeah.
You know, the last one being with Adele on stage.
Yeah.
Now, recently, you now reminding the president of the dim the light moment in the White House now.
Yeah.
So any new iconic moments now?
Yeah, that happened in Washington, D.C. when we were there for the Oval Office meeting.
Yeah.
Not really, but so here's the funny thing. So earlier this year, in around June, I was in London, actually. And that was the holiday before this one, when I went for my birthday. I was in the Seychelles about 2 weeks ago. The funny thing is, when I was in London in June, I went to see Beyonce.
Wow.
Because I've got, you know, I've got friends who really like Beyonce. I'm not really a big fan, but I love seeing her live on stage because I think she's an incredible performer. So I've seen her in Atlanta like 2 years ago. And when this opportunity came, I was like, I'd love to see her again. So when we went, my friends were like, could this be the other Adele moment? Like, could Beyonce call you on stage? And I said, well, Beyonce doesn't work like that. So my hope, their hopes were probably with that holiday than the Seychelles, because there I was literally just resting. I woke up late. I just read a book. I went into the ocean. I was in the pool and I was having my cocktail and I read a book and the same I was repeating every day.
Yeah. I want to know, Clement, how many leave days do you have, my brother? Because it's like you are always on holiday.
So you must maximize. You must maximize on your leave days. And I found a way to sort of, so here's what I would do. Like sometimes what I would do is I would work a lot of public holidays.
Yeah.
Just so that I can somehow sum up on my leave days. So when the year begins, I'm that guy that's going to be at work and I'm the only on-air presenter that's working on a public holiday. The rest have taken leave because I know that I'm trying to build up my days because I love traveling. I've been a traveler for years now. That's like the only thing that makes me feel like I rest, especially with the job that I have. The only time I can switch off, it's not when I take leave and I sit at home and I nap for the next 5 days or go see my parents, as much as that fulfills me. Like me resting means I need to get on a flight and leave Mzansi.
Trust me, I've, as one of your followers, I've seen that and I know that very well. So now explain something to me. You Pedi.
Yes.
Right? But your surname is Manyathela.
Yeah.
And you're from Mpumalanga.
Yes.
How does that work?
Yeah. So my dad is Kimu Pedi.
Yeah.
My mom is Ndebele.
Oh.
Ndebele. And my dad's family is from Limpopo in Modimolle.
Okay.
So, you know, the story of land dispossession and when all of that happened, the family just disintegrated and they went to different parts. And some people in my dad's family came towards Mpumalanga and they settled in Mpumalanga. And that's where my dad met my mom. But yeah, Manyatela, that's what they say. So there's a bit of a Nguni influence of sorts in the lineage, and that's where it comes from.
Okay, no, kaikwishisha no.
Oh, kaikwishisha. Yeah, but yeah, fully a Pedi surname. I can't speak because in the family we do have people who speak. There's a language called Sitokwa. I can't really speak it, but there are some in the family who can, and yeah, there's that in the lineage somewhere before us, but when we came in it was just fully they were speaking Sepedi, and that's really what we're taking down the generations.
Okay, now that's nice. I was very I really wanted to understand that element. So now when I want to go back a bit, right? So when you were young, what did you dream of becoming though?
When I was young, I wanted to be a gynecologist, and then because it was so, it sounded so fancy, and I remember there was a time when I was watching television, and there was a gynecologist I think being interviewed, and I asked a relative of mine like, "Oh, that's a gynecologist. That's a doctor who deals with issues women have," but I really took it because I thought it sounded fancy and the person who was being interviewed looked rich. And all I wanted was, I just want to have money. I want to be able to be successful. And I think that's just a career that came up on television. And then as I was growing older, when I was applying for university, I applied to study biological sciences at VETS. And even with that, I didn't really know what biological sciences is about. I just thought, this sounds fancy and it sounds like it's going to make me a lot of money. So let's go for it.
Wow.
Thank God I am terrible in math and physics. And I was naive to think I would become that without mastering maths and physics. So because of that, I was accepted for biological sciences, but I don't think I would have gone on to become a gynecologist because that needed you to pass mathematics really well. And I didn't pass it really well. I passed it, but it wasn't an A.
How far would you say you are from that life, from what you are today?
From which life?
From being what you wanted to be as a young kid.
So first of all, I'm fulfilled. I'm happy, which is what I wanted. I do think that I have a successful career. So from that point of view, I think I'm satisfied. I think I'm happy with the choices that I've made because I'm really happy. I think I've got an incredible job. I'm doing incredible shows that are doing really well. So I'm happy with the direction that I've taken. So I think that young boy is probably proud. I hope.
Wow. Wow. Now he is. He is. You speak, because I mean, like I said, I tune into your show every day.
Thank you.
Right? And you speak so openly about being from Mpumalanga. Mm-hmm. And how is that moving from Mpumalanga to Gauteng, both like professionally and personally? How is that move like for you?
So the first move happened when I went to university. I studied journalism at the University of Pretoria. And I remember it was such a culture shock for me. I've never had a white teacher before in my life. Because I'm from a village. I went to village schools, Narabulela Sepedi throughout. That's the language we spoke. So when you are now moving to university, you have to speak English the whole time. And I remember thinking, oh my God, English is not my mother tongue. I'm going to struggle here. And the lectures were there. In fact, at the time at UP, they used to do dual language policy. So the lectures sometimes would tap into Afrikaans and then English. So that was the first culture shock for me, that I had teachers that were white. And I was like, oh my goodness, how is this going to work? And then I had like friends or maybe like fellow students that I was in groups with who came from like better families. Like by better, I mean like financial, you know, the families. I mean, some of them were coming from rich families. They came to school with cars, and all of that was new to me. I've never seen that before. And I did feel like I'm an outsider. Whenever we would have conversations with my friends, some of my friends at university, because some of them would say, yeah, let's meet for a group meeting when we finish our assignment. Maybe it's 7 p.m. in the evening. And I would think, oh, they don't actually understand that some of us have to walk all the way from Sunnyside in Pretoria all the way to Hatfield, because I used to walk to school every day. And that just shows you how some of them, they know that they're being dropped off by their drivers or their parents, and some of them had cars to come to school. So that was the first culture shock I had, like personally.
Yeah.
And then, of course, moving to Johannesburg and starting to work. How was that for me? I found Joburg to be so fast.
True.
Yeah, I found Joburg to be really fast. And yes, I'd spent time in Pretoria, but as a village boy, I used to think, sure, this city is so fast. But at the same time, it was so vibrant. I still loved it. I loved that it was like this interesting melting pot for people from different backgrounds and different professions. And that fascinated me a lot.
Nah, I share the very same sentiment with you. And don't get me started with Afrikaans myself.
Yeah.
When I came back from Moors, having to learn that with the accent also. It was terrible. It was very terrible.
Yeah.
Now, you taking over what is now known as the Clement Manyathela Show is phenomenal. So I just want to know from you, what gave you the courage to go for it and the confidence to take over or fill in such big shoes?
I didn't have the confidence to do it in the beginning. I didn't. When I was asked to do the show, I remember it was in 2020 around May. I loved being a field journalist. I was a passionate field reporter. I was covering politics. I used to travel with the president whenever he's got state visits in India, in China, in other countries. That's my thing. And I've never had any ambition to do the 9 to 12 slot ever. Never thought about it in my life. But more so, I never thought I would ever be asked to take over someone that I admired so much that I thought was probably one of the best broadcasters in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So then with that context, imagine my shock when I sit down with the station manager back in May 2020, Tabsile, and she says to me, we want, as a company, as a business, to shift your direction a little bit. We think you are going to be great here, and we want to give you the show to do. And I remember thinking, one, I was shocked, but then I was also upset, because I thought, these people are setting me up for failure.
Mm.
How would you ask a 28-year-old or 29-year-old at the time to come and do a show that requires somebody who has had enough life experience, whatever that means, because that's how I was thinking at the time. I don't have enough life experience. I'm not married. I don't have kids. You know, I haven't had my heart broken many times. I haven't broken hearts too many times. And I just felt like, I needed some life experience of sort, and I didn't have much. But number two, I didn't think that my career had blossomed enough for me to do a show like that. But number three, I didn't really care much about the show in as far as presenting it myself. I've never wanted to do a slot like that because it requires a lot. I'm not a vulnerable person. 9 to 12, you don't just do news. You don't just do current affairs. People, the show only succeeds when you open up.
True.
It only succeeds when you build a community and you are vulnerable with that community. And I wasn't sure that I was able to get to that point where I can be vulnerable. So I said no for about 2 weeks. And I was like, no, I can't. And then they said, just consult and come back to us. And I went, consulted a few friends, a few family. I prayed a lot about it. And I decided, okay, I'm going to give it a shot. And I came back and I told them, okay, cool, let's see what we can do. And they said, you have total control. Tell us what show you want to build. And we started sitting down and I started building the show. I came up with the features that I think will work on the show and where I think we want to push the show to. And I'm glad I said yes eventually.
Wow. I'm glad that you said that, because the reason why I'm asking this question is because, you know, a lot of people, they spend a lot of time contemplating or not wanting to chase their dream, waiting for a perfect moment. And I just want you to share your story as well. And also, maybe if there's someone watching, what advice would you give them if they really doubting to take that leap of faith?
I think one of the things I've learned from my experience is that you have to allow life progression. I think we get too obsessed with structuring our own lives, which is good, right? Planning is good. Like planning, what do I want to do in 5 years? What do I want to do in 3 years? What kind of career am I going with? But I think sometimes it's okay for us to be comfortable in knowing that things are going to happen and opportunities are going to be presented to us and we must embrace them. And I think part of the reason, in fact, the biggest reason why I wasn't taking the opportunity is because I didn't trust myself that I am capable. And for me, the lesson is just trust that you are capable. I mean, there are opportunities that come and we say no to them, and those opportunities could absolutely change our lives, but we don't have confidence in ourselves. And I think that's what I've come to learn, that sometimes allow life to progress, and when the opportunity is presented to you, do consider them. It can be an immediate no, you know. Consider them, because that actually may be what you are supposed to do. I'm convinced that I was born to do what I'm doing now. I am absolutely convinced. In fact, I'm more convinced than when I was doing field reporting as a journalist, as much as I loved it. Wow. I've always thought there's something bigger. There's something else. So, yeah, just embrace opportunities that life gives you, man. And don't say no without even considering, just because that contradicts how you have planned your life. So it's okay to shift things around.
Wow. Wow. And how do you think you can build that confidence?
How you build the confidence? How did I build it? Let me use my personal experience. Yeah. So when I consulted with people, I consulted with people who know my journey, who know where I come from, who have seen my career progression. And those people reminded me of how good I was at what I do. And they reminded me of how any opportunity that has come in my life, I've taken it with both hands and I prepared and I did it wholeheartedly, and it's become really successful, and I'm capable to make this, that success. So one, it was consulting people that you trust and people who know your career progression. And because they were able to remind me of the talent, because sometimes we forget that, you know, because it's awkward to really look within and acknowledge something good about ourselves, because then we're like, oh, you're so vain. But actually, sometimes it's okay to say, oh, I am actually good at what I do. And maybe that's why the opportunity is here. And I will make this a success because I am talented. We always avoid that. And I don't know why society has sort of, has sort of positioned us like that.
Wow.
Not to, because we are so scared to also take, like, I don't like compliments. Like when people tell me, oh, I love your show so much. That's the most uncomfortable thing ever. I always find a way to change the subject.
Isn't that like more of like validation to say, I'm doing good. I'm doing good.
Yeah, it's just weird when people say it to me for some reason, right? And that's weird, because why is it weird for people to point out that, oh, what you're doing is good? I don't know. But it's that. So I build that confidence from talking to people, but also working hard. You know, for me to get to the point where I'm so confident in the show I'm doing now is I've had to work so hard. Like, The first thing I did was, and which was a mistake, was I thought of, oh, I've got big shoes to fill. Mm. And there were a few mistakes I made there in hindsight, because I was writing about this just the other day for my Gibbs assignment. And I remember the biggest mistake I made was, oh, I've got big shoes to fill. And that statement, I never, ever want to use it again, because I don't think we're supposed to fill other people's shoes. I think we're supposed to bring our own shoes, because you will never fit properly in anyone else's shoes. And that's what I've learned. Because when I started the show, I tried so hard to be like the previous host. I did. In how he asks the questions, in how he speaks, I was trying, because I was trying so hard to fit in the shoes. And the minute I realized that that's not working for me, I threw those shoes away and I brought my own shoes, and they fit so perfectly. And I think that's one of the lessons I've taken here. So the second thing was, I over-prepared everything, because I was like, I want to prove myself. I mean, there were, you know, what many people don't know is that when I took over the show, there were certain people who were big fans of, you know, the former host.
Yes.
Who didn't accept me at all. They used to just call in to criticize me. They used to send messages to say, why are you doing this show? You are terrible. And that gets to you, hey? It gets to you. And I remember I used to over-prepare my interviews because I wanted to prove myself. I wanted to say to these people, I can do this. And which was good over-preparing, which is something that I still do to this day, because I do think that I wanna know the subject matter so well so that I'm able to represent the audience better. But I was doing it for the wrong reasons. I was trying to impress a community of people who didn't think that I'm capable. But the minute I thought, I need to build my own community, that's when everything just worked out.
Lovely. There can only be one Clement.
One Clement.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the comfort and the rough diamond is.
Yeah.
And I can tell you're doing amazing.
I'm
a fan of the show. I tune in every day, and I love the topics. So it's my number one show.
Thank you.
Now, Clement, as a journalist, right? What are your processes in crafting the right questions?
So I have become to be, like, I've got a reputation of, like, asking the difficult questions. And I say that in inverted commas, because I don't really see it that way. I just think I'm just asking basic questions like any other journalist who is prepared for an interview should or they ask. In fact, I got a call from a prominent person just the other day. And the first thing he says on the call is, the most feared journalist. And I said, when did I get that? Because I don't think I am the most feared journalist, and I don't want to be. And I'll tell you why. Because there are certain politicians who are scared to come on my show. Mm. They are. And they tell me straight up that, hey, when I say Aksaba. Mm. And I'm like, but I don't want to have first of all, it's wrong for politicians to do that. But two, I mean, I don't want people to say, no, I won't go there because, oh, this guy asked the tough questions. But also, I'm not going to start being easy on how I ask questions because, I'm scared that people are not going to come to my platform.
Don't you think maybe they're shying away from accountability?
They are, which is why I'm like, that is wrong. Like, as a politician, you must subject yourself to accountability. Mm. But we've picked up that with the producers. Where they even tell my producers, some of them, that, not Clement. So, wow. which is a bit weird. But to go back to your questions about how you craft is, you have to prepare. Mm. Like, bro, I prepare for my interviews. Mm. There is no conversation that I will have on my show when I don't read an article about something and I go do an interview about it. Mm. If it's about a court matter, I need to read the court papers. Mm. If it's about a constitutional matter, I need to go to that section of the Constitution. I need to read it myself. If it's about a regulation, I need to go, what does the Bella Act say? Mm. Read all of it. Because that way you are fully aware and you are fully armed with information that then makes it easier for you to really seek clarity and seek answers. That's how I do. And the last thing I do is I'm always in touch with people that know better than me. So I can't tell you how many times I've got lawyers. Like if I'm talking about a court matter, trust me, I've spoken to an advocate before. Hey, this is what the story is. Help me understand, what does this act say? What does this regulation say? Why is it crafted in this way? If I'm talking about the national dialogue, trust me, I'll call someone in the presidency. Hey, off record, tell me, why was this done? When was this decision made? How does it connect? By the time I come to you on air, trust me, I have had enough conversations to be confident in what I'm going to say, which is why, and I sometimes get into trouble for this, like sometimes when I start the show on the open line, I've got strong comments about people and topics. And the reason I can have those strong comments is because I've done research and I've spoken to people and I'm confident in the position I'm taking.
Wow.
I know that nobody's going to come later and say, you lied or you got this wrong. I am so confident that I can go and say, this person is wrong. Right?
So, hearing you speak now, is that the reason why you are fearless? Is it because you are prepared?
I know. I'm prepared. And I know that I have cross-referenced what I'm holding with experts or people who know better the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always speak to different parts. Like take the Mkhonazi matter, for instance. I will always go to him or people around him. I'll always go to Shadrach Sibiya, people around Shadrach. I'll go directly to the Minister of Police and people around him. I'll go to someone who knows Brown Boholtzi or Ked Matlala, the arrested people. I always ask, what do you know? What can you share with me? By the time I come on air and I make a comment, trust me, I've spoken to enough people, and maybe that's, you're right, the fearlessness comes from the confidence. I'm not taking chances. I know what I'm talking about and I'm confident in it.
Wow.
You can challenge me on it and I will defend it because I know what I'm talking about.
And what markers then do you use to gauge that this was a successful interview, this was a good interview?
What makes a good interview? For me, because for me, it's not just like, is it trending? It's not like, interview doesn't have to trend for it to be a good interview. The interview doesn't have to be like, I don't need to go in a screaming match with a politician where we're screaming at each other for it, even though some listeners love action like that for some reason. Like when you're disagreeing with someone and it's a back-to-back. For me, what makes an interview good is when there's clarity that is sought. Because I go into any interview with a reason. Like, for instance, this morning, I wanted to understand why the Minister of Higher Education appointed administrators to go and, because he has placed 3 sitters under administration. Yes. I wanted to know, okay, why did you appoint administrators to go to these sitters? What happened? Where are the governance failures? But I also wanted to know, why would you appoint the administrators and then only do the background check of the administrators later? Because now he's appointing the Public Service Commission to say, oh, vet these people, but you've already appointed them.
It's too late.
What are you vetting them for now? Because there are complaints from other parties. That's not good leadership. And that was what I wanted to get today on the show. And I spoke to the CEOs of the sitters who explained fully what the state of their sitters are and what the process the minister was supposed to follow that he didn't follow. For me, that's a good interview because the listener then understands better that this is what the law says. And they now know the minister, seemingly in this case, didn't really follow the law according to these CEOs. And this is what's going to happen if the minister doesn't reconsider the decision. Like once the questions I have are answered in any interview, I'm like, okay, I'm happy. I think the listener knows better. You know, he's empowered with information.
Okay. Do you ever get moments where like questions are not answered?
Yeah, many times.
Frustrating.
It is. But I trust my listeners because I do think on 702, we've got the best listeners in town because they are very opinionated and sometimes they know better than you. So I learn a lot from them. They learn a lot from me. But I trust that they know how to make their own assessment and conclusions from an interview. I don't need to say, yeah, he refused to answer this question. Sometimes I'll ask one question and someone responds in a bizarre way. And I just move on because I know that I've hit the spot. The listener listened and heard, and they get it.
I have, when you say you have the best listeners, I have to give my shout out to my fighter, Kustas.
Kustas, yeah.
Yeah. So in all the interviews that you've conducted, was there any moment where a guest said something that really moved you or changed you?
Negatively or positively?
Let's say both.
Both. Sure, bro. Many times. Like,
is it?
Many times. Let me start negatively. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of... I get into trouble for asking the questions I ask. You know, because especially, you know, some politicians in this country think we have to worship them. And I've been a political reporter for so long. Like I said, I've crisscrossed the country to follow, you know, future presidents campaigning. I've traveled with the president overseas on state visits. I've gone to ministerial events. And I've seen how people who work with these politicians, they, oh, minister, you know, Baba. They are very like, they treat them like they are some queens royalties and kings. So when the minister sits in front of you and you ask the tough questions, sometimes whether it's a premier or whatever, some of the politicians sit there and think in their mind, you can tell the way they look at you, like, who the hell do you think you are to ask me that? So it comes out, I can see sometimes in the attitude, I see in the responses, I see in politicians after the interview who will tell me straight down that I'll never do an interview with you.
Wow.
And not because I disrespected them, but because I just did my job. I just asked questions they were uncomfortable with. So there was recently a guy who is with the taxi association, one of the taxi associations, who threatened me basically on air, because it was during the time when listeners were complaining about taxi drivers who are not allowing them to give lifts to people because you don't have a permit. That's not lawful. And I was challenging this guy who said, yeah, we want to make sure. So he was trying to justify that if they find me in my car with you, they will stop us and say, how do you know this person? And we have to be able to prove that Peter is my brother. They even said to one guy, kiss this woman to show that he is indeed your wife. And when I was trying to challenge him on that, and he was like, yeah, he basically threatened me on air and said, you're provoking me.
Oh.
And he's known as a very, well, in fact, people were tweeting me and saying, Clement, do you know how dangerous this man is in Mpumalanga? So it's things like that where they happen, you know, that are negative, or when politicians afterwards say to you, I'll never do an interview with you again.
Oh.
And then positive all the time. I mean, I've got a feature on my radio show called The Hanging Out Feature, which is more lighter. And yeah, I'm always like listening from a perspective of wanting to learn from my guests. So there are many things that they say that really empower me and make me a better person. I'm trying to think now, but there are many. There are many things.
Wow. You know, you just touched on a very sensitive subject right now. And I personally, it's also frustrating for me. And the headlines all over the place about recently the incident that just happened, Ko Soweto, where the Uber driver was burned in the car. I mean, that is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And you start questioning ourselves, where are we actually going as a country? You know, so that is really disturbing. So the fact that you were threatened on air, was it on air?
Yeah, right. Live on the radio. And then he cut the call afterwards.
is there a moment where you ever regretted asking a question or not even asking the question?
Yeah, there are moments where I've regretted not asking a certain question. Because, you know, not every interview is perfect.
Yeah.
In fact, in every interview that I've done, I've never walked away 100% happy.
Really?
I can be 99.9%. But it's never 100% because I'm a perfectionist. Like, I'm very critical of myself. So sometimes I'll think, oh, the way I phrased that was wrong. That's not good English. I should have said this. Oh man, I should have asked this question as opposed to this. Or, I should have remembered this. historical thing that happened in 2002. Mm. And I didn't. So, yeah, most times I'm more regretful of questions I didn't ask than the questions I asked. Because I've prepared. I know that the questions I'm asking are important. I've prepared enough to know that the questions I'm asking are good. But sometimes it's, oh, maybe I forgot to ask a specific question. Mm.
So when you hear citizens voicing out their daily struggles on your show, what does that tell you about the current state of our country and the caliber of our political leadership?
Yeah. I think we've had a crisis of leadership for a while. I think we have. And I think many people have been worried about the trajectory this country is taking, even before the GNU. I mean, make no mistake, since 1994, there's a lot that's been done by the previous administration. There have been successes. I mean, we have a painful history in this country with colonialism and apartheid. And there's a lot that's been done. Advancements have been made. But equally so, there's a lot that's also taken us a number of steps back. And I worry that, I don't know if there's been proper accountability so that we avoid that happening again. It's like with the national dialogue, I'm like, okay, are we just going to talk about solutions and the challenges the country is facing? Is there no space for accountability there? Is there no space for us to look back and say, okay, sure, these are the challenges, but how did we get here? And I think that's a fundamental mistake we're making, because we're not asking how did we get here. And without reflecting where we come from, it's very easy for us to make the same mistakes going forward. So I'm conflicted about that dialogue, that as much as I think it's important for us to talk, I think it's important for us to reflect and where we made mistakes, acknowledge them and avoid making them again. So I think, yeah, we're there in our country where I just think we've got politicians who do and say things for their political expediency. And I just wonder where we're going to go.
Do you think our politicians understand what accountability is?
Not all of them.
Because from where I'm sitting, there's a lot, I don't know how to put it, there's a lot of excuses for not owning up.
And that's why I'm like, political expediency, because them not owning up, it's because of political expediency. Because if they do own up, then that means that may affect their political career. Like some politicians are thinking really about their futures, and yes, they'll lie to you and I and say they exist to hold the executive accountable, to push for our own interests as stakeholders, as their constituency. But is that really the case? I wonder. I think we've got so many challenges in this country. I think we are at a crossroad, but I don't know if, for instance, a dialogue is then what takes us from this crossroad.
Looking at South Africa's current situation right now, in your own opinion, what are the conversations that we should be having and that we are avoiding?
Why are we enabling the lack of accountability? I think we need to reflect also ourselves as South Africans, because we are the ones that vote and therefore empower the same politicians who take us for fools. And I just think, in fact, I think some of us have an obsession with a cult personality. Like there are certain politicians we love so much that they can never do anything wrong. And I always say on my show, trust any politician at your own peril. Like, I do not trust any politician. I do not. And even the ones that I would vote for, because I think politicians are politicians and they will do what politicians do to make it to the top. It's about power. I've never met a politician who's just happy enough to just be, I'll be on the sidelines, I'll be here. Like, you do your thing. I don't really want power. So, and I think we are not holding them accountable because some of us are blinded by our love for Cyril Ramaphosa, or for Julius Malema, or John Steenhuisen, or for Shadrach Sibiya, or Ntandla Mkhwanazi, whoever it is. You're so blinded by the love that even when they do something wrong, you're unable to see that. Because for you, and this is what cult personality and following is about, is it doesn't matter who does what. We are resolved on this. We support Peter and that's it. I don't think that's healthy. And we do that a lot in this country.
I think that's an issue.
I think that's a serious issue.
You know, as you saying that, I'm not going to mention, but there's a political party that comes into mind when you're saying cult. And they mean well, but I personally just don't agree with how they tackle issues.
And if you say that, they come after you. If you say, oh, but I don't agree with you guys on this, attack. And it's not even, oh, let's actually have a conversation like mature adults. And I've picked up that there are instances where sometimes they won't say stuff, right? There are some people who are in parties that won't say stuff until certain leaders have said them, because then, okay, now we can say, then we don't contradict our leader. And then sometimes when a leader says something they disagree with, they can't contradict it. It's almost like, no, it's like God has spoken. How dare you disagree with a higher power? I just think that's, I don't think that's healthy. And I think we've allowed that in our society. And that is what emboldens politicians to do as they please, because they know that they've got your support no matter what. And we need to get to a point where politicians know that, sure, I'll support you, but if you do something wrong, I can also withhold that support. Or I can criticize you. I can tell you where you are wrong.
Yeah. Wow.
So I think we need to reflect on that. Because I always say, you know, because I do get attacked a lot, because I criticize everybody. I criticize the EFF, ANC, DA, you name it. And it's funny because on the day that I criticize the EFF, then I call, oh, you hate EFF. You're a DA supporter. And then on the day I criticize the DA, yeah, we've always seen you. You are an ANC or EFF supporter. On the day I criticize the ANC, yeah, you are too mean a journalist. So it's like that. So I'm like, that's weird. And the fact that there are people out there who are not seeing it, yeah, we need to reflect on ourselves. I think it starts here. We've allowed this to happen.
Well said. We've allowed this to happen.
Yeah.
Well said.
We have.
Now, we both know that media can shape how people think.
Yeah.
How do you carry that responsibility every day with your line of work?
It's a powerful tool, hey? It's actually a scary responsibility. You know, I would be on holiday and people, if there's a big story that happens, like people still tweet me and say, please come back. I want to know what you think about this.
Do you get it?
I get, I mean, before I go to bed, I already have people tweeting me and saying, I want to know what you think about this and this and this. So there are a lot of people who formulate their views on certain things, and you're a big contributor in that formulation process. And I think that's a huge responsibility. That needs to be guarded because it can be misused. So I try to keep myself in check. You know, I really do try to keep myself in check because, and the first thing I normally do is I always advise listeners that don't just take what Clement says. Like, do your own research as well. Like, read something, you know, because I always hear people say, my wife always tells me, my wife will get home and say, yeah, but Clement said. I was like, what if I get it wrong? I'm human. I can't get some things wrong. So I think it's important for us to get into the culture of, let's get the second opinion. Like, because there may be somebody who holds a different view to what I have. Get the second opinion. Read something. Don't just take Clement's view or opinion. But it's a huge responsibility, man. There are thousands and thousands of people who listen to what you say, and they formulate their view, many of them based on that. And I'm just constantly checking myself, like, is what we are doing fair? And I'm not the only one, right? Like, I don't just decide what I'm going to say on air. Like, I've got a team of producers. I sit down and I tell them, okay, well, we discuss, all of us, like, what are we talking about today on the show? If a listener says this, like, because we always look at the big stories. These are the stories that are likely to come up on the open line, or stories we will throw out. So they also check me. Sometimes they'll say, why are you holding that view? That view is wrong. Or you said this last week. Like, we don't think this is the way to go. So I always listen. I've got people that I trust to help me check this responsibility I have so that I don't misuse it.
Wow. That is good to know.
And I trust the team members. Like, I trust my producer so much. Yeah.
Do you think we are using these media platforms effectively enough to inform, empower, and, like, drive real change?
Not enough. Because I think sometimes we get into the system of, like, the mundane, usual things. Like, let me give you an example. Like, on my show, on the radio, I've tried, like, to introduce, like, a series on something. And I know some of my colleagues at 702 and outside also do that. That helps us really introduce other conversations that ordinarily wouldn't fit on the features of the show, right? And for me, for instance, I had a feature that I did, a series that I did about what happens when we die. Because I'm fascinated by spirituality lately in my life. Like, I'm in my spiritual era, so I'm reading a lot of spiritual books. I'm watching, like, a lot of podcasts that talk about spirituality, because I think we're not doing enough as a human race to be curious. Like, we're so satisfied with our physical bodies. Like, we think this is what humanity is.
I think people are just scared, Clement.
Maybe, yeah, right? So what? Are you just going to be scared and just not know?
You know, they say what you don't know doesn't kill you. Yeah.
Like, true. I don't know. Like, I think we need to try help teach society that it's okay to ask the questions. Mm. Like, that feature was about a human body is physical, it's spiritual. You may have a soul. Do you believe in that or not? And people will believe in all three elements, but they don't care much about, oh, if I have a spirit, this is what happens to it. Mm. Like, I'm fascinated by that, because then we are not fully experiencing the human experience. If we focus on one element, which is this physical body, and, oh, I go to gym, I wash. Okay, but if there's another part of me that makes me human, how am I taking care of that? So I try to use my show to educate people. So to answer your question about the platforms and whether they're effective enough is, I already know, like, Current Affairs, we're good. Like, people who come to us know that we'll give them the top stories. Like, if there's a big interview we can do, we'll do it really well. Like, we're good, Current Affairs. They already trust us. Our research shows that. But I'm like, what am I imparting? Like, what am I trying to change? I'm trying to get people to understand that, like, group thought is problematic. Like, you know, we got to an era at some point in our society across the globe where this is when cancel culture was brewing now, where, you know, if people make mistakes, then cut their heads off because they don't deserve a second chance. And all of us have to hate that person. When Peter has done a mistake, I can now be seen with Peter. Because, no, but group thought says we hate Peter, therefore all of us must hate Peter. And I don't think that works. I don't think that works in any society. And don't mistake that with the lack of accountability. I'm not saying Peter must not be held accountable for what he has done wrong. Of course he must. And if he must lose a job, he must. If that's what necessary and is required at the time, mm-hmm. even by law, whatever the case is. But I'm saying that I have come to learn that even in the media industry, there's almost like this unspoken rule that, oh, are you going to interview that person? Really? Why not? Like, why are we not learning to be comfortable with the fact that a different platform can decide to have a conversation with someone else? You may disagree with that, sure, mm-hmm. but does that then mean that that platform must not exist? I'm not sure about that. I think we must ask questions, especially about platforms, especially if that interview ends up being like people are being homophobic or they're being sexist or whatever the case is. I mean, you know about mm-hmm. how some podcasts end up saying things just because they want followers. Mm. It's like they exist to, in fact, they're cheapening the platforms yeah. because for them is, what's going to get people to follow us? Let's say these outrageous things.
Now, on
that's
that
not
note,
building us.
On that note, right, do you think that everyone's opinion now, on that note, do you think everyone's opinion deserves to be heard on these platforms?
So, I do think that opinions can be heard, but if you're going to put, yeah, let me preface it this way, because some opinions are harmful, right? You and I can disagree on any issue, but you or I can hold a very problematic, harmful opinion. And I think if you want to platform someone like that, there's a greater responsibility on you to at least challenge that in a way. You can't just platform someone to spew hatred and vile. I think then there's a greater responsibility. So, yeah, you want to hear other people's opinions? Sure, do that. But it can't be that you just platform them to spew hatred. I mean, I don't think I would platform anybody who is proud of, I mean, anybody who goes around saying, kill the children, for instance, or kill black people or kill white people. I wouldn't platform someone like that because I'm not really interested in the reason for that, because fundamentally, that is wild. So that's more than just a different opinion you hold. I mean, I believe that all people must exist and live. You can't kill them. You think they must be killed. I don't care what your reasoning is. That is absolutely out. So you make a judgment based on whatever opinion is being held. But if it's not harmful, then the responsibility is on you to challenge it.
Yeah. Power comes with responsibility. I think for me, let's just be more responsible.
Absolutely.
Yeah, with these kind of platforms. Mm. Let's just be responsible. Clement, if you were to send one direct message, right, to our South African leaders, what would that message be?
Jeez, how much time do you have? Okay, one. Because I always have a lot to say to leaders.
Say it.
And I say it. And I say it to them when I interview them. And now I'm trying to think, what's the one thing? Okay, so maybe to our leaders, I would say, just for one second, like, put yourself aside. Because isn't that what leadership is about? It's not inward looking. It's not about you. It's not me, me, me. Like there's a whole constituency out there that you are serving. It's servant, servitude, and just be a servant. Because, I mean, that's such a simple thing, but actually there are many leaders out there who exist and they're too comfortable and too excited about their positions. And they're so emboldened and they're so powerful from their positions that they forget that they're here to serve. And when you are here to serve, you don't steal from people. When you're here to serve, you don't refuse to be held accountable, because that's part of being a servant. Like, you are held, you are literally, you have a responsibility to those people. So just be a servant.
Wow. I pray to God they are listening.
I pray too.
Now, you know, there's this topic, right, that I took it upon myself to say, you know what, every opportunity that I will get to sit down with people like yourself that are doing well in their respective fields, careers, leaders, business people, there's this one subject that we don't really talk about, and which is the personal cost that comes with what you are doing. You know, people look at you and they see Clement succeeding in whatever that he's doing in his work. He's doing great, but they don't get to see what happens behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Right. So for me, I want to know from you, what has your career demanded from you mentally and emotionally?
A lot, bro. Like, you know, I said to a friend last week, I was like, because it hit me like I had an epiphany. And I was like, oh my God, my career is so lonely, actually. It hit me hard. I was like, it's actually lonely. And I'll tell you why. I saw a video of me on TikTok. I'm not on TikTok, but you know, people will take whatever you say and put it out, or videos you have. And there was a video of me with the president. You referenced it earlier, where I said to the president, "Ooh, you're traumatized by the lights." So there was a moment where me and him were talking secretly, intensely with each other.
I think I saw the
video. Yeah. And it was like me and the president were sharing a moment. We were actually talking about something that happened in the US. And we had a chat, and then that video started making rounds on TikTok, and people starting to say, "I am Ket Matlala, the businessman who's so associated apparently with the police minister in some way through Brown Bokgotsi." So that begins, right? I mean, I didn't make much of it because I thought maybe because we've got a beard, but I understood later why people were making that association. And then a week ago, I see a clip of me, of someone who put a clip of me on Instagram, on TikTok, and says, this is another corrupt journalist. And actually, that clip was now doing the rounds where I'm being asked about it. How did you see a clip of someone saying you are also corrupt? I was like, okay. And then it was just doing the rounds. And that's when I had a conversation with a friend, and that's when it hit me how long the career is that sometimes you are trying to hold people accountable. You do interviews with them, or you say certain things, and what you're going to get in return is the people who support the leaders you're trying to hold accountable then go and start rumors just to taint you, right? Because all you've done is do your job. And that's what my job has done. Being a brave journalist that's going to ask the questions no matter what comes with a price. Like, you receive death threats. I've received death threats. There were times when I used to leave, especially my evening work at the SABC, when I drive out, their cars parked outside, and I worry, and I'll be on the phone with friends. I'm like, I think there's a car following me. There's a people who will say to me, who will tell me, I'm going to wait for you outside your workplace. Like, I have had incidents of people who come, wait for me outside my workplace. When I leave Prime Media, they follow me, and then I will go and park at a garage.
To date.
This is an incident that happened like 3 years ago, and someone just followed me from Prime Media, and then I went and I parked at the garage, and then the person came, and because they wanted to confront me about something. I've had someone who invites me to a meeting under the pretense of, we want to talk about business. Right. They wanted me to work with them on something because they used a valid organization. And I know the person works for a valid organization. And when I sit down, they're confronting me about something I have said on air that they didn't agree with, that they hated so much, that they're willing to lie to call me into a meeting. So there are moments like that. Oh, politicians who say, oh, I'm never going to come speak to you on the show. Mm. So I think there is loneliness actually that comes with just the job that you do, because, and I don't want to make the mistake, and God help me, I don't want to ever not ask a question because I'm scared of the reaction. I want to hold anybody accountable, whether it's somebody I like, whether it's somebody I don't like. I don't operate like that when I do my job. That is why I will go out. Like, I don't care that there's like 99% of South Africans love this person. If that person has done something I think is wrong, I will go out and I'll talk about it. And I don't ever want to get to a point where I pause and I'm like, should I? Because then I'm not being honest in my work. The other day I criticized the KZN police commissioner because there's a journalist that asked him a question about a court case that was ongoing. And then he responded and said, I hope you're not receiving drug money. And I went on air and I said, I think that's unacceptable. If a journalist asks you a question, either you say no comment or block them, or if they disrespected you, call them out. But for you to make suggestions that somehow they're receiving drug money is wild, unless you can back it up. And if you're not, if you know about that and you've not reported it, that's also reckless. Yeah. You're a reckless leader. Because there's a journalist who's getting bribe money, you've never reported it. And there were certain journalists that texted me on the side, because I tweeted that and people were attacking me. How dare you? You. And then there are journalists, even members of parliament, who are texting me and saying, we agree with you, but they're scared. Imagine, you're a journalist, you're a member of parliament, you're scared to disagree or point out where this police commissioner is wrong at. Mm. That doesn't mean you hate him. That doesn't mean you are questioning the work that he's done, which is incredible in KwaZulu-Natal as a police commissioner. It just means you're picking up something that is wrong. So that behavior is going to be enabled because you are scared, because you're scared of the attacks. I don't get scared of that. And I don't ever want to be scared to do my job because I think, oh, I'm going to train because people attack me, or a politician is never going to want to talk to me. Then that's when my job will be done. Like, I don't think my conscience can take that. Mm. I'm willing to take the risk.
Wow. You know, Clement, you keep touching on very sensitive subjects. You know, when the minute you said, because some people are scared, my brain just went to these headlines that we keep getting nonstop about the whistleblowers, where you tune into the news, someone who was just trying to do good has been gunned down.
Yeah.
People are even being shot at court, killed.
Mm.
So that worries me.
Yeah. Because criminals are that brazen now. At court? In broad daylight?
That worries me as a country. Where are we heading? That really worries me.
Mm.
Now, how do you then mitigate all of this? What keeps you focused and sane? Do you have any routines that you do? I know for one, you like traveling.
And I love golf, you know, and I love Formula One.
Mm.
Like the stuff, and I love running, you know, I run marathons, I've run Comrades. So what do I do? I mean, if I tell you, there are certain friends of mine, even my parents, who've asked that I get security many times, and I said no.
Really?
For years, because they were concerned about just how much people can hate you for just doing your job.
Mm.
Which is wild. And I think that's just a sign of where we're heading in this country. When journalists now are going to be scared to do their jobs, that's a very part of an important part of our constitutional democracy, free media, the free press. I wonder if people realize what this actually means, because any country that has gone to the ground, that's where it begins. With the press. That's part of the science. But anyway, I digress. How do I... Is I... I run a lot. I think that helps me just like remember to just recenter myself in a way. Like I love running. I play golf a lot. I love traveling. And when I travel, I really switch off and I'm just like, let me rest and not worry about anything else. And those are the things that sort of like, you know, they always remind me that, okay, you're still on the right path. Just keep on doing what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I pray a lot.
Nice.
I do. I talk to God a lot. And I'm like, if my work here is done, let it be so. If it's not done, then give me the strength to keep on pushing and doing what anybody in my position should be doing. Mm-hmm. Just ask the questions. Just do your job.
Have you ever gotten to a point where you had to choose between telling the truth and or protecting someone?
Not with my job.
Mm-hmm.
Not with my job. Because the thing is, so when you've done this, because I was a political reporter, I've got relations with politicians, but and not relations, isn't they're not my friends, but I get along, like I've got their contacts, you know, I can text them. There are times when some of them get into trouble, hey, I get so hard on them that they get shocked. You are so hard on us. You were so hard on me. I was like, well, yeah, I'm doing my job.
Mm-hmm.
Like take the former U.S. ambassador to South Africa, Ruben Brigitte, the one who said,
who lied
and said we gave our arms to Russia to fight in Ukraine. I've played golf with him.
Really?
Yeah, I have. And after that, I've had him on a show and I was hard on him. Like, because people also think that because you're asking the tough questions to these guys, then you hate them. Or I don't. Like, I'm okay with many of them. In fact, a lot of them, I'll ask them the toughest questions and then they'll send me a WhatsApp and say, yo. You killed me today.
Mm.
Like they laugh, and then we laugh about it.
Sure.
It's like in Parliament, we see Julius fighting with the president. Like, do you know these people, when they see each other in an event, they greet? You know, they can sit and have coffee.
Mm. And that's, you know, lately, especially, I don't know if it's this week, there's this trend that's going on now with our leaders getting out of character. There's one that just happened now on air where a leader told go to hell.
Yeah.
You know, what's your position with these kind of behaviors now?
So I think we spoke about this on my show last week, actually. So first of all, I know the general, like, you know, personally, like beyond work. I mean, I'm actually due for golf with him. But He's someone who's got, like, he really loses patience easily. Like he really loses patience easily. So that's number one. That's his personality. For as long as I've known him as a politician, he loses patience easily with people. And then, but the second thing is, and I did in fact call him out because I do think that he was wrong. For saying to someone, go to, especially to the host, now we'll go to hell. No, I don't think there's a way you justify something like that. But I also think that we need to be gracious towards politicians as well. Like, they're human beings.
Yeah.
I think we get to a point where, and I gave an example like on show last week, that it's like with our pastors, the minute someone is a pastor, we put them on a pedestal like they're supposed to be so angelic and holy and godlike. Nobody can be godlike, at least in my context of God. So, and I remember one pastor one day talking about how he was at a restaurant and he wanted to really have his steak with some red wine. He couldn't even do it because there was someone from the church in the same restaurant who's probably going to go out and say, oh, I saw a pastor have a glass of red wine.
Ah.
That's where we have, I think even with our politicians, we expect them to be these holy human beings that must just be perfect like this, so they can't lose it. It will happen. Sorry, what happens to me is, what do they do when that happens?
Mm.
like, are they accountable enough? Is Bantu Olomisa able to come back and say, actually, I realized that I was wrong there. Maybe I should have been calmer and responded better. What do you do afterwards, for me, is what matters than a politician who's going to lose it one day? Because I think they're human beings and we must be a little bit gracious. The same way that I may be wrong one day on air. Like, I'm not a perfect person. And then what? Like, I'm a terrible person because maybe I conducted an interview wrongly and I was just emotional. I think we need to have grace for people. But in the context of our politics, again, I go back to what we've enabled. There are people who are justifying that because they just love General Holomisa so much that he can never do anything wrong. And then they end up justifying it. Even when you debate them, they really lose an argument. But it doesn't matter. He's our general. That's not good.
Yeah, no. Now, sure, Clement, you are really dropping bombs on me. Now, you are known for holding individuals accountable on your show. Now, in your personal life, what's that one value that you never compromise on?
There's so many. But if I were to pick one value that I wouldn't compromise on, I think that's the truth. I suppose that's because it's so central in the work that I do as a journalist. Like, I care about the truth. Like, and it worries me when the people will lie, especially when what they're lying about is affecting other people. So, yeah, I think the truth. I care about the truth, and not just in my job, but in the way I live my life. I try uphold that all the time.
Now, when your name is mentioned, 20, 50, 100 years from now, what do you hope people say?
I hope that they're going to say that I was brave. And I hope that they will say that understanding the context where we would have found ourselves in that time, which is where we are now. Like, years from now, I really hope they can say, oh, that was a brave journalist. Like, he didn't want to compromise on seeking the truth and trying to hold them accountable, no matter how many times they try to discredit him or to attack him or to threaten him or to refuse to go to his shows. I hope that I will be remembered as that, because I think we need brave journalists, and we've got a lot of them in this country. Like, you know what Peter Louis Myberg has done, the IDT CEO, who tried to pay a bribe to a journalist. So having journalists like that who are brave enough to go, I'm going to investigate this, not knowing that they're putting their lives at risk, knowing that you are exposing yourselves to potential attacks, but you still want to do it because somehow justice matters to you. Yeah, I think that's what I want to be remembered for, among other things.
Wow. Well, my brother, at least I will also say that at least I gave you your flowers, man. You're really doing an amazing job. And shout out to you. Shout out to everyone that's doing the same line of work with integrity. And shout out to my fighter again, Titi Madia, as well.
Yes. Love it.
You know, so we have a special segment here on the show, right, called the Masterclass. So this is where you, as our guest, get to share anything with the people. It can be an idea that you think more people need to hear, or it can be an advice that you want to share, anything. So, Mr. Manyatela, the floor is yours.
So, any advice? Okay, so I have been interested lately in issues of spirituality.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the advice I'll give, that just be curious.
Wow.
I have been reading books. I've read, and I'm even reading the Bible again now, from scratch, because I'm trying to understand so much about the human experience. I think all of us that are here, we've been privileged enough to be part of this human experience. I think that's a privilege. Like, can you imagine if you were a soul looking from outside and you're looking at souls that have now embodied their bodies and their spirit, like, and you see them doing that, like, wouldn't you be envious from the other side? I think I would. So we have the opportunity to live, and nobody has the answers around where to and what the purpose is. I mean, we can assume, I mean, all of us thought our purpose was something else in our lives, and something has come and changed your direction. It happens with other people. So I think for me is, spirituality is so vast. The human experience is so vast. Like, we are not just our bodies. Let's be curious. Let's read books. Let's find out, why are we here? Like, who were here before us, and how did they live? What were their principles? What were their values, and how has that changed? I always think about even the next generation, like 100 years from now. What do you think they'll be saying about us and how we would have lived our lives? So be a lot more curious about life. That's it. And I think we obsess too much, especially for people who, like, when you're a Christian, when you're a Muslim, when you have chosen a religion, there's so much obsession about, or African spirituality, that what you, if that's what you practice, there's so much obsession about just that. And I don't know. I think God is too powerful of a being or a thing that he would be so linear enough to say, this is the only way, or this is the only thing you can, through which you can come to me. I think there's a reason there are so many religions. I think there's a reason there's so many of us with different skin colors, with different cultures, with different languages. Like, you go to Asia, you're here on the continent, you go to the Americas. That's how vast our God is. You know, if he was so linear, he would have just went, okay, I just want Muslims there. Oh, I just want Christians here. And that's it. Let's just have black people. Let's just have white people. So if he's so varied, if it is so varied in his expression of his love for us through different cultures, through different races, why are we limiting it only to that? And I think we're doing ourselves a disservice. I'm not saying go change your religion. I'm saying just be curious. Like, if you really think your God is that big, why are you limiting him so much? Then he's not big.
No, this one is a topic for another day, honestly. Wow, but my takeaway is, let's be curious.
Be curious.
Oh man, now I have a lot of questions.
Yeah.
This one is a topic for another day. Yeah. Let's be curious.
You're not going to lose anything. Just be curious. And I mean, do we really think the God, the creator, whatever you believe in, this powerful being, is going to penalize you for asking questions about your being here and wanting to actually walk away from this world having fulfilled what you are here for? I don't think so. I think he likes it. I think he actually does want us to be curious. Like, I said to myself, so 2 years ago, I read a book. I was on holiday in America, and my holiday book was A Year of Yes by Shonda Rhimes. And I made a decision that year that this is a year I'm going to say yes to a lot of things. Like, and there's a lot of things I said yes to. I mean, I started executive producing television shows, you know. I said yes to going back to school. I started studying at Gibbs. Like, there are so many things that I've seen in my life just from declaring, reading that book, and I said, that's a year of yes. This year is different. I said this is a year to be open spiritually. And I'm not kidding you. Everywhere I go, there's a spiritual link to something. Like someone is going to buy me a spiritual book, or I'm going to be at the airport, and while I'm in the lounge, I'm talking to someone and it gets to the issue of spirituality. Or I'm going to be a guest on television. My core guest starts talking to me about issues of spirituality. Literally, it's following me everywhere. And that's the power of that declaration.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
No, it's not.
I think there's so much power that us as humans, we possess. Yes. And we're really not tapping into it because we are not curious enough.
We're not curious, and that's it. Yeah. We'll never really know our power, because all we're doing is we have taken whatever we've been taught to be and to do, and we are taking it as it is, and we're walking. We are no different. We basically, what we're going to do is this, we're just going to replicate the previous generations. That's how they lived. That's what they followed. That's what we do. But we're supposed to elevate. I mean, the reason that this generation, that's why they say you are your ancestors' wildest dreams, is because there are certain things they couldn't achieve. You're supposed to elevate to another level. How are we elevating when we are maintaining the same thinking process from the past and we're not trying to learn? We're not trying to be curious. It's a disservice. I think we're not fully experiencing this human experience. And for you to bow out when it's your time, when that time comes, for you to bow out and you're satisfied, it would be so sad. Oh my goodness, I hope that doesn't happen to me. I don't want to bow out and I've not asked questions and I've not explored other scenarios, because I think I know it all. You don't know it all. None of us do. None of us can say for certain. That's why you are here, and that's where you are going from here. Nobody can say for certain. Yeah, you can believe it from your cultural beliefs, religious beliefs, science, whatever. Nobody can say for sure. And yet we still are comfortable with taking whatever we are taught and whatever we are told and run with it without questioning. Yeah, I became a different Christian because I used to be a... In fact, our pastor used to say growing up, you don't question God, don't question the word.
You know, I was about to say that to you when you said, I think God likes it. But I'm like, there's a verse somewhere in the Bible that says, I think the biggest sin is questioning or,
then,
you know.
I'm sorry, but I'm not comfortable with a God like that. I'm not, because I also don't want to follow a God of other people. I want to follow my God. Right? I think all of us have unique relationships with our God, whatever your God is that you believe in. The God I believe in, I think actually does want me to know him better. How do I know him better when I don't ask the questions? How do I know him better when I just take whatever he said and I run with it? You know how many times people quote verses and you ask them, okay, but do you actually know what this means? Like, what do you think this says about God? I don't know, but it's in the Bible. Come on, man, what world is that? So if the Bible said, go kill your mom and your father, what, just do it, but you can't question it. Why? Because that's what it says. What world is that?
Wow. Curiosity.
Just be curious.
The big takeaway is curiosity. Yeah. So we have a tradition. Yeah. Every guest comes in. Yeah. Before I let you go, you leave behind a legacy note. And what I will do with these notes is that I'll be compiling them into a book. It will be a book of wisdom from great people like yourself. So, Clement, if you're ready, you can put the note in the box.
And I don't need to tell you what the note says, right?
No.
So people will find out about it.
They will find out about it.
When that moment comes.
That's it. Thank you. Thank you so much. For me, this is a special moment. You know, your words will live beyond this episode. And I think for me, that's what legacy is at the end of the day. So before I let you go, I have a quick little game that I just want to play with
Let's
you
go.
Quickly. And the rule of this game is you don't have to think much.
Oh my God.
I hit you with your question, you just
respond
go.
In 2 seconds.
Yeah. You ready?
I think.
Let's go. Sugar beans and what?
Sugar beans and pop.
What's your go-to karaoke song?
Fantasia, When I See You.
If you had to switch careers tomorrow, what would you do?
I think I would be a spy. But the ones from the movies, like who know how to.
How white lemon.
And then they've got money all around the country. They can get on any private jet. And
What's one thing people will be surprised to know about you?
I am incredibly shy. I'm the most shyest person you'll ever come across.
Wow. If you could have dinner with any historical figure, who would it be and why?
Ooh, any historical figure?
Yeah.
Oh my God, there's so many. Alive?
Let's say dead or alive.
I would have wanted to sit down with, like, let's say Chris Hani.
Wow, it's a good one.
Yeah, he was a radical. Mm-hmm. He was like questioning the status quo and even his own leaders. Mm. And at the time, it was not really fashionable because the ANC was about to get into power. So you needed to be fine with people because once the ANC is in there, you'll be sorted with positions, like you'll be fine in government. I love that. I love that he questioned curiosity and he questioned the status quo.
Wow. For me, it will be Credo Muta.
Oh, that as well.
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
I've got a lot of people, man. I really have a lot, but wow. Because I'm not supposed to think about it, then yeah. I'll say.
No, Clement, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your insight, being open. And sharing powerful quotes with us today. I honestly appreciate it. I am very honored that you joined me today. I'm glad that I got through this interview because I'm sitting with someone that does this. So much pressure.
You did better than I would have done it.
That means a lot coming from you.
No, thanks.
To you, our audience, thank you so much for tuning in. If there's anything that resonated with you in this powerful conversation with Clement, please do like, share, comment, and don't forget to subscribe. Until next time, this is Success Unscripted with Peter Manjat. Mr. Clement.
Lovely.
Kalebo.
Thank you, Peter. Nice.